You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Holiday 2020-2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of The Oracle of Brit by Haley Phelan. The truth behind Britney Spears' case may be stranger and sadder than any theory. It does strike us in the legal profession as strange, says Lisa McCarley, an estate planning and probate attorney based in California, of Spears' conservatorship. McCarley hasn't worked with Spears, nor has she any connection to the ongoing conservatorship, but the case caught her attention nonetheless, and recently she's been joining in at the rallies to show support. Even up in Sacramento, when I talk to legislators, they say, "What's going on?" Nobody understands it. Spears' case is being adjudicated in probate court, which typically handles the conservatorships of elderly people with cognitive disorders like Alzheimer's or dementia, and people with severe brain injuries. In other words, people who are not likely to get out of the conservatorship. In cases of mental illness, such as bipolar disorder or episodes of psychiatric crisis, conservatorships are usually handled by mental health courts. There, a conservator must petition each year to renew the conservatorship. In the probate sector, conservatorships can go on indefinitely. Though McCarley says she's not exactly a fan of the pop star, her daughter, who is now 26, grew up listening to Spears. That song, Lucky, that played over and over and over in our house, she recalled. Her interest in the case is broader. To me, it's just another example of the dysfunction of the Los Angeles, and for that matter, Orange County Probate Court, she said. That's why I got involved, because we're seeing families being traumatized, exploited, abused by a system that is supposed to protect families and their loved ones. Conservatorships are very hard to get out of, much, much harder to get out of than to get into, and that's something many people don't realize, even people who are seeking conservatorships, said Zoe Brennan Crone, a staff attorney with the ACLU's Disability Rights Project. After Spears' lawyer Sam Ingham filed the paperwork opposing Jamie Spears as conservator, the day before the August 19th hearing, the ACLU tweeted in support of the pop star, writing in part, "If Britney Spears wants to regain her civil liberties and get out of her conservatorship, we are here to help her." There are other valid reasons to be concerned for Spears' circumstances. In the summer of 2019, her two sons were granted a restraining order against their grandfather after Jamie Spears allegedly physically assaulted the older child. And then there is Lou Taylor, Spears' former business manager, whose husband is a pastor at Calvary Chapel Brentwood, an evangelical church whose website offers this stance: "God instituted monogamous marriage between male and female as the foundation of the family and the basic structure of human society. Therefore, we perform marriages in accordance with the Bible, consistent with the Old and New Testament." Considering the overlap between Spears' fan base and the LGBTQ+ community, Taylor's affiliation with Calvary Chapel seems contradictory. On BreatheHeavy.com, Taylor has been a frequent target. "I mean, some of them call her Lucifer," says Miller. While he's not a fan of how out of hand the online vitriol can get, tearing someone else down doesn't help Britney, he explains. He does think Taylor's dealings deserve greater scrutiny. Next, photos. The eyes have it. The conspiracy theory spread based on this Instagram photo, which some fans believe Spears used to send a message to call 911, written in her eyelashes. What happens in Vegas? Spears performs at the 2001 MTV Video Music Awards. A performance of the Las Vegas Piece of Me show. And with Paris Hilton at a 2006 Hollywood Hills party. The Brit Army may have had cause to celebrate just a few weeks after Miller and I spoke. For reasons that remain unclear, Taylor resigned from her position as Spears' business manager, according to an October 28th letter from Jamie's lawyers, included in court documents filed by Ingham. Spears was not given notice. Instead, her father quickly replaced Taylor with Michael Caine without discussing his appointment, salary, or terms of employment with Spears, a switch-up which Ingham objected to in the new documents, calling it part of a blatant attempt by James to retain full functional control of her assets, books, and records. For legal advocates like Brennan Crone, there simply aren't enough checks and balances when it comes to enforcing conservatorships, and therefore Spears' situation is worth a second look. Data collection on conservatorships is limited, but according to Brennan Crone, we know it affects a large number of people, tens of thousands of people, and people with a wide range of disabilities. She notes that some conservatorships are appropriate, just, and supportive. But, she says, there are other, less restrictive options. There is this perception that conservatorships are harmless, but there are risks that many people aren't aware of, she says. Conservatorships are a serious imposition on a person's civil rights, and so there needs to be a greater barrier to entry. We are going to keep showing up, and keep showing up, and keep showing up until Brittany gets free, said Chris, 28. What they're doing may be working. 2 weeks after the hearing, Spears' lawyer, Ingham, filed court documents arguing that the conservatorship case be unsealed. It also appeared to suggest that Spears not only knew about the hashtag Free Britney movement, but supported it. At this point in her life, when she is trying to regain some measure of personal autonomy, Britney welcomes and appreciates the informed support of her many fans, Ingham wrote. Far from being a conspiracy theory or a joke, as James reportedly told the media, in large part this scrutiny is a reasonable and even predictable result of James's aggressive use of the sealing procedure over the years to minimize the amount of meaningful information made available to the public. I thought it was really interesting that in those documents there was a photo of a protest sign saying Jail Jamie, Free Britney, Investigate Lou, Miller said suggestively. In fact, the court documents had included an article from page 6 in which Jamie Spears refuted the validity of the hashtag Free Britney movement. The article included a photo of a protest sign as well as a photoshopped image of Britney Spears waving behind prison bars. Then, just days before the September hearing, new court documents posted by ET were making the rounds of the hashtag Free Britney community. These new documents filed by Ingham revealed that an hour before the last hearing in August, Jamie Spears asked the court to reappoint as Spears conservator Andrew Wallet, the guy whose petition for a raise back in 2018 got Barker and Gray of Britney's Graham seriously interested in the case. Ingham goes on to allege that the last-minute move was, in part, a retaliation to Spears' refusal to perform, which will require Jamie Spears to undertake drastic changes to her budget. Apparently, this frugality does not extend to the fees James pays from the conservatorship to the financial professionals with whom he surrounds himself, he continues, noting Wallet's extremely expensive salary and calling Wallet uniquely unsuitable for the role as co-conservator. According to the documents, Spears would like to work with a corporate fiduciary who can offer both a physical office and a team of independent financial professionals rather than a single individual handpicked by her father, who is a complete stranger to her. Later, Ingham would have even stronger words for James, arguing in the November 3rd filing that Brittany and her estate will suffer loss and injury if James is not suspended immediately as her co-conservator, following the appointment of said independent trust. Ingham has said that Spears continues to move in the direction of greater autonomy, and also that she has stated she does not desire to return to performing at this time. As this story was going to press in mid-November, Ingham told a judge during a reportedly contentious hearing that Britney Spears will not perform again if her father is in charge of her career, emphasizing that the star fears her father. Although the judge approved Britney's request to add the Bessemer Trust as co-conservator, at this time, Jamie remains her conservator. The day before, a video was posted to Britney's Instagram showing the pop star in a crop top and low-cut jean shorts, cycling through her signature poses and twirling a rose in front of her face. "Definitely a hidden meaning here," wrote user Sia13Rose. "We may never know the entire truth behind the Britney Spears case, but as is our uniquely human birthright, we will believe what we want to believe." Stare at that photo of Spears under the awning of a sunlit tree long enough, and I swear eventually you'll see it. The words, "Call 911.
Thank you.
What Follows Hope, a conversation between Barack Obama and Jessamyn Ward. Photographs by Annie Leibovitz. Opening photo, New Chapters, Obama and his daughters in 2006. And President Obama sits at his laptop with his daughters looking on. Interior offices, DeLisle, Mississippi. Washington, D.C., Jessamyn Ward, a National Book Awards winner for two novels, logs on to Zoom. Behind her, children in fedoras clamber up the sofa, trying to glimpse the screen. The 44th president appears, ready to discuss his new memoir, A Promised Land. Obama, are you still there, Jessamyn? Ward, yes, I am. I don't know what happened to my view. That's okay. You've seen me before. You know what I look like. Ah, there we go. Can you see me now? I've been seeing you the whole time. I want to ask you about humor, because it was such a surprise for me, but I don't want to disparage your other work. I laughed out loud, like really laughed out loud. There's no hyperbole here. Several times during my reading, I talk about how to use humor when I teach creative writing. I was wondering if that was a conscious decision on your part to incorporate it into your work, or if you learned how to do that through reading. First of all, Michelle is funnier than me. I have to say that because she insists that she is. She's naturally just a great storyteller. There's a rule in our household that she can tease me, but I cannot tease her. I pointed out that's not fair, and she says, yeah, so what? I am often the brunt of her humor, and the girls have picked up on that. So at the dinner table, generally, I am the recipient of mockery and jokes. I think that all of us use humor to some degree or another to help explain the world around us. The human condition can be absurd, and if you learn to laugh about it, then that helps you get through pain and hardship and difficulty. It's part of the reason why the African American community has been the source of so much humor in our culture generally, because we've had to face up to the absurdity of things happening to us that don't make sense, aren't fair, are often tragic and heartbreaking, and so we empower ourselves by being able to pull out and take a bigger view. That was part of how I managed to maintain perspective and take the work of the presidency seriously, or running for president seriously, but not take myself too seriously. There's a scene I write in the book when we're debating whether we can still move forward on the Affordable Care Act. My legislative director says, it's a really narrow path we've got here. It depends on whether you feel lucky. And I say, listen, where am I? He said, well, you're in the Oval Office. And what's my name? Barack Obama. No, it's Barack Hussein Obama. I'm always lucky. I always feel lucky. That was an example of using humor at a time when the stakes were incredibly high and we were feeling really embattled. All of which is to say, yes, Jessamyn, I am funny. I slayed at the correspondents' dinner. The professional comics never wanted to follow me. Come on. I remember that, and I'm going to agree with you that Michelle is very funny. There's that part when you go to the beach with Sasha and Michelle doesn't go, and she says that was her one aim as First Lady, to never be captured on film in a bathing suit. I couldn't stop laughing. Well, she wasn't joking about that. I could tell she was serious. She was serious. This is one of my main goals as First Lady. I will not be photographed by the paparazzi in a bathing suit. And she succeeded. You explicitly talk about empathy several times in A Promised Land. One of the things that I was really impressed by was how well you developed your characters. There's a huge cast, from Hillary to characters who have secondary roles, like Norm Eisen or Sonia Sotomayor. But still, every character, you give us a very specific impression of them from the first moment. You give us sensory details. You give us hints about their personality and their motivation, and they are really vivid. I ask myself, how is he able to accomplish this? So often, when we see a political figure or we're talking about policy, we somehow think that's separate and apart from our daily lives. What I wanted to do for the reader, particularly for young people, is to give them a sense of commonality between their day-to-day choices, decisions, insights, hopes, fears, and what somebody who ends up being the President of the United States is going through. He is a person like you, who is interacting with people, who is trying to do stuff, is disappointed sometimes, is afraid, falls short, has doubts. So in order for people to capture that progression, that journey of me as a young person inspired by the civil rights movement through my early political career, all the way through to the presidency, that required people to have a sense of how I saw the world. The empathy you describe is central to my politics. The reason that I got into politics was the sense that, as shattering as the experience of race and discrimination and slavery and Jim Crow and the decimation of Native American tribes, all that stuff was, there is still something in this country that says we can be better and we can learn to be more inclusive and see each other and expand our definition of we the people. That, in part, is what I think readers want from memoir. They want us as writers to slow down, open up moments in seeing with other people. Look, you think about your own books, Jasmine. Despite being African American, I don't know what it's like to grow up in Mississippi or a rural part of the South. I certainly don't know what it's like to be a pregnant young black girl growing up in the South. The act of you describing an interior life makes me understand her and stand in her shoes and see through her eyes. And that expands my world. And that should inform how I interact with my own daughters, with the people in my community, and hopefully informs my politics. If you think about Donald Trump, he had a certain story he was telling about this country. I have a different story. Joe Biden has a different story. Kamala Harris has a different story. So we have these competing narratives that are taking place all the time. And I think that the insight, the wisdom, the generosity that you show in your books is part of what I want to inform our political life as well. If we can understand each other in that kind of granular way, as opposed to just, all right, that's a white male, that's a Hispanic female, that's a rich person, that's a broke person, those categories in the aggregate can give you some data, can give you some insight into how the society is organized, but it doesn't really give you a feel for what's turning inside us. Thank you for that. I feel like that's part of what I'm attempting to accomplish in all of my work, just trying to get readers to feel with and for the people who I'm writing about, in the hope that there will be real world, not consequences, but real world, it manifests itself. Outcomes, yeah, exactly. There's a ripple effect. That's the power of empathy. And the reverse is true. If you can't see somebody's backstory, that's how we end up reinforcing our prejudices, our biases, our fears. That's how we then perpetrate cruelty on other people. There's a reason why Ralph Ellison titled his book Invisible Man. We're not seen. We were invisible for a long time. You look at what happened with George Floyd. There was an element of that visceral recognition of this is a human being who is in dire straits, and we can recognize a part of ourselves in him. We can imagine what that's like. It's not an abstraction when you witness that, and that changed attitudes. In creative nonfiction work, we always say that you have to think about yourself as a character and think about how you're going to convey your defining characteristics. Throughout A Promised Land, you're so good at making the people that you write about, including yourself, seem complex and multifaceted. and capable of all the emotions along the emotional spectrum. There's power in that, because then the reader perceives you as a complicated human being, and perceives the people that you're writing about as complicated human beings. Well, I appreciate that. Part of the advantage that I probably had in writing this book was having written an early book, when I was pretty young, about my journey to understand my father and my heritage. By the time I wrote this book, 25 years later, I had had a conversation with myself about, all right, where did I come from? What cross currents run through me? What are my demons? What are my fears? There's probably more confidence at the age of 58, 59 in letting that show, letting readers see that, being less protective of yourself. I wasn't like student body president. I wasn't from a political family. The inspirations I drew from were also young people, a John Lewis or a Diane Nash. They were in their early 20s, taking on an entire system of Jim Crow and putting themselves in such severe danger. I didn't duplicate that kind of courage and success, but in my own way, I said, all right, let me try this out. I wanted people to see the ups and downs of even a successful political career. I tell a story about how, being frustrated in the state legislature, I decided to run for Congress without really thinking it through and getting whooped, and how I then went to the Democratic National Convention in 2000, licking my wounds, coming off a loss, and it's a good story about how I show up in L.A. It turns out I don't have the right pass, so I can't really get in the convention hall. I've run down my credit card, I'm broke, I can't rent a car, I'm not on the list for the parties, I'm sleeping on a friend's couch. I end up leaving, and 4 years later I'm the keynote at the Democratic National Convention, and sort of the belle of the ball. The point is, I want people to feel those ups and downs of public life, which aren't so different from the ups and downs of all our lives. Do you think that's part of the reason why you were so committed to writing towards intimate, sort of painful moments that you experienced? From, say, losing that election, or there's a lot about how difficult it was for you and Michelle to navigate your relationship. That pain is often some of the most profound experiences that we have. It leaves scars. It shapes us. I want people to know that we all have in common loss. We all have in common disappointment. We all have in common that sense of things not being in our control that we thought were in our control. Again, I think that has to inform our politics and our public lives. I talked briefly in the book about Jeremiah Wright, who was a hugely controversial figure during my campaign, who was an extraordinarily gifted, complicated person, one of the most gifted preachers I ever heard, built this amazing institution that gave back to the community of the South Side of Chicago. But he had a bunch of pain from the experience of being a black man who had grown up in the pre-civil rights era and went through the revolution of attitudes in the 60s and was still angry and hurt, and in that way reflected the anger, hurt, scars, pain of the black community, and would then sometimes let that out in ways that weren't always on point. When you hear people say, well, we need to talk more about race, sometimes I'm skeptical of those conversations where they're this formalized, let's have a dialogue about race, because so often we actually avoid talking about the stuff that really matters. It's one of the great values of literature that often we're able to access that pain more effectively. When I say literature, it doesn't have to be fiction. I mean, obviously, Beloved and Toni Morrison's work does it. But The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin remains as relevant today as it did when he wrote it over 50 years ago. It is searing, and it is all about pain, and ultimately it's probably as necessary. You're very honest in your assessments, in the context, in the history, in the way that you communicate, in your emotions. Your first book, to me, resembles A Promised Land, I guess in form and in a way how intimate it is. How much freedom did you feel like you had to be so forthright? I didn't find it difficult to share what I felt or thought. I'm 59. I've been around the track a bunch of times. I said to somebody once, one of the great gifts of the presidency is that you lose your fear. Look, I came into the presidency in the middle of what was then the worst financial disaster and economic crisis since the Great Depression. We had two wars. I had to make a series of very difficult and risky decisions early on. Some of them worked. Some of them didn't work as I had intended. I was, like all presidents, subject to withering criticism at certain points and second-guessing. And I survived it. You look at it and you say, well, I'm still here. I've made some good calls. I've made some mistakes. I've experienced losses as well as some victories. And lo and behold, although my hair is grayer, I'm still standing. So I felt free to describe what I truly thought about a whole range of issues. I think what was probably more difficult during the writing process was how much I felt comfortable sharing conversations I had had or feelings others had. With Michelle, for example, obviously a lot of the book is the story of our love and our partnership and the sacrifices she made for the career path I chose. And needing to be honest about the fact that she really didn't want me to be in politics, and it hurt her in a lot of ways. I was helped by the fact that she wrote her book first. She had already put out some of that, so that it wasn't so much me, you know, pulling back the curtain. She had already done that. I was just giving my perspective. But there were times where, as I was writing, I was like, well, this snippet of dialogue, would that person feel comfortable with me sharing it? The decision I made was that as long as I was generous in my assessment of their outlook and what they were feeling, then it was okay for me to share it. Probably how I phrase things in the book might be different than how I would phrase things if you and I were just sitting around the kitchen table. If I'm talking about Mitch McConnell's filibusters, blocking important legislation of mine, I'm probably more judicious in how I describe that than if you and I were just talking. There might be a few expletives sprinkled in there. I'm trying to maintain a little bit of decorum. But you did. Hey, yeah. Joseph Biden recently won the election. Hallelujah. Yes, a real full-body relief. I feel like people are more clear-eyed about the fact of how we have to be more civically engaged and civically minded. There's a difference in understanding now that I don't think was there, and I definitely was guilty of it when you were elected for the first time. You wrote that you had a sense of double consciousness. You were anxious about this idea that people were projecting their needs and desires and wants and dreams. It was like wish fulfillment, all on you, and you were aware of that. Do you see a difference in our ability to be more clear-eyed? Well, look, I hope so. We always want to learn from our experience. I'm glad you raised this, Jessamyn, because I really think this is one of the goals of the book, is for people to understand a little bit more about how our government works. We have this sense that the president is a king, who we elect him and hopefully at some point her, and whatever it is that they want to do, they can get done. The president is extraordinarily powerful, but so is Congress, and so is the Supreme Court, and so are corporations, and so are governors. Oftentimes, I think people, particularly Democrats, but this is undoubtedly true for Republicans as well, think, all right, we got this person elected. Now, when are we going to reform the criminal justice system? When are we going to make sure that we have universal daycare? Why haven't we immediately dealt with climate change? And when change doesn't happen fast enough, we have a tendency to feel cynical and disappointment, and then disengagement sets in. I go into detail about how hard it was to get the Affordable Care Act passed, for example. At the time, there were a lot of Democrats and progressives who said, well, this isn't good enough. Why don't we have a single payer plan? There are still people who are uninsured, even after the bill got passed. It's not enough. I try to explain, whew, we had to pull every rabbit out of a hat that we could to get 23 million people health insurance. We can start saying to ourselves, all right, yes, we need to elect Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, but now we also need to make sure that we have a Democratic Senate. We saw this summer this incredible outpouring of activism around criminal justice and police brutality. The fact of the matter is that the overwhelming majority of criminal laws and prosecutions take place under state law, which means that if you really want reform, then you've got to have district attorneys who believe in reform. And you've got to have mayors who are appointing police chiefs who are willing to negotiate with police unions to make sure that their training and accountability is different than it currently is. The president can encourage it, as we did after what happened in Ferguson. Occasionally, you can get the Justice Department and the Civil Rights Division there to impose a consent decree on a particular jurisdiction so that it changes its behavior. But most of those decisions are done locally. That doesn't mean, by the way, I recognize the fact that I was a symbol, and that symbol is important. I was just seeing your kids and your niece and nephew. There was a generation of kids who grew up seeing an African-American first family in the White House. That didn't just have an impact on African-American kids. It had an impact on white kids who took that for granted. It was not unusual to see, suddenly, a person of color in that leadership position. That has value, too. It's not all about policy. It's also about spirit and inspiration. So I don't denigrate the symbolic role of my election. But it is not by itself sufficient to change the history of discrimination and the structural inequities that have built up over 400 years. What do you want us to take from a promised land? In addition to thinking this is a good story, in addition to young people hopefully being inspired that maybe I too can get involved in public service in some fashion, even if it's not elective office, but I want to be involved in the course of our society. More than anything, I want people to come away with a sense that I really do believe America is exceptional, but maybe not for the reasons that sometimes we think. It's not because we're the wealthiest nation on earth, or we have the most powerful military. It's because, uniquely among great powers throughout history, we are not only a democracy, but we are a multiracial, multi-ethnic democracy, and that we have fought battles internally over several centuries now to try to expand the number of people who can sit at the table, who qualify as we the people. Black folks and poor folks and women and the LGBTQ community and immigrants. If we can make that work, if we can learn to embrace a common creed and respect each other and treat every child in our care with regard and concern, then that is what makes us that shining city on a hill. That's the example that the world looks for. That American idea is worth preserving. But it only works if we acknowledge that the reality and the idea don't match. What we love about America is the fact that we are noisy, and we'll protest, and we complain, and we fuss, and we struggle, and at each juncture, then we become a little more just, and a little more fair, and a little more empathetic, and more voices are heard, and more people have a seat at the table. If we don't learn to live together, we will perish. We can't solve big problems like climate change or global inequality unless we can see each other and listen to each other and learn to work together. And I hope that anybody reading this book says it's worth us investing in the promise of America, even as we understand that, as Moses understood and Dr. King proclaimed in a speech just right before he got shot, we may not get there, but we can see it. And it's on behalf of those beautiful children of yours and my daughters and children everywhere that we keep on fighting to make sure they get there, even if we don't. This interview has been edited for length and clarity. Gemma's Gift by Johanna Desta. In the next year, we'll see Gemma Chan improvise with Meryl Streep and play an immortal alien. Seems like she's up for a challenge. Gemma Chan was photographed for Vanity Fair in Los Angeles in November. Photographs by Geneva Adium and styled by Rebecca Ramsey. And she wears various fashionable outfits. Not so long ago, actors exerted a gravitational pull, tugging production assistants, makeup artists, hairstylists, sound editors, cinematographers, and directors into their orbit. In the COVID-19 era, the polarity has reversed. Anytime an actor walks on the set, there's someone on the loudspeaker going, "Shields on, shields on," says Gemma Chan during a Halloween night Zoom call. You just feel like, oh my God, me being here makes it worse for everyone. The difference is stark, particularly for Chan, whose career exploded after her breakout turn as glamorous cousin Astrid in 2018's Crazy Rich Asians. COVID hasn't slowed the flood of projects, even if it's upended the way Hollywood works. In Steven Soderbergh's dramedy Let Them All Talk, based on a short story by Deborah Eisenberg and slated to hit HBO Max in December, Meryl Streep plays a stern literary giant with a debilitating fear of flying. Chan is the eager agent who convinces her to take an ocean liner to England with two of her closest friends, Diane Wiest and Candice Bergen, and her nephew, Lucas Hedges, to collect an award, and then slips aboard herself. Immediately after that shoot wrapped, Chan pivoted to Marvel's more colossally scaled Eternals. The actor played a wicked alien warrior in 2019's Captain Marvel. Now, in her second outing at the studio, she becomes Cersei, an alien furnished with all the best superpowers: telepathy, telekinesis, superhuman strength. The film, directed by Chloe Zhao, follows a group of immortal galactic heroes, Angelina Jolie, Salma Hayek, and Kumail Nanjiani, to name a few, across 7,000 years, but Chan can't reveal much more than that. She's the most human-loving of all the Eternals, and she really appealed to me, Chan says carefully of her character, as though stepping over a tripwire that would alert the Marvel spoiler police. She's incredibly empathetic. Chan was recently named a spokesperson for L'Oreal Paris and began filming Don't Worry, Darling, a psychological thriller directed by Olivia Wilde, which also stars Florence Pugh and Chan's old pal, Harry Styles, whom she's known for almost a decade. They were all a lot younger when she and the pop superstar met, she quips, her posh British accent lending the line a storybook wistfulness. On Zoom, Chan is gracious and unfailingly polite. She's also politically minded, so much so that she brings up the presidential election, the global climate crisis, and the pandemic before I can. The actor nearly ended up on an entirely different career path after emerging from Oxford with a legal degree. For 2 years, she repeatedly deferred a job offer at a law firm, then enrolled at Drama Center London to study acting. Telling her Scottish-Chinese mother and Hong Kong-born father about her change of heart was painful, she has said, because education had raised her dad out of poverty and allowed him to immigrate to the UK. Thankfully, Chan's acting career bloomed quickly and her parents came around. She began booking parts across television, Doctor Who, Secret Diary of a Call Girl, and film, Fantastic Beast and Where to Find Them, and then Crazy Rich Asians blew everything wide open. Let Them All Talk was largely shot over a single week during the pre-COVID summer of 2019, aboard the ocean liner RMS Queen Mary II, a ship so large it has its own planetarium. The cast and crew worked by day, while the famously efficient Soderbergh, who also served as his own cinematographer and editor, edited footage by night. Hundreds of the ship's passengers happily served as extras. In another guerrilla filmmaking move, the dialogue was almost entirely improvised, making Chan's very first scene a tense lunch in which she and Streep's character negotiate the ocean journey even more stressful. She was really lovely, Chan says of the 3-time Oscar winner, but I definitely was a bit sweaty. Soderbergh's directorial notes occasionally made her nerves comically worse. I think at one point Steven said to Meryl, Look at her like you're looking at a bug, says Chan, bursting into laughter. In retrospect, Let Them All Talk was an idyllic experience. The Queen Mary II operated as a 148,530-ton art cocoon, with the film's cast and crew commandeering different sections of the ship in the name of movie-making. Chan loved it. Something funny happens when you've been at sea for a few days and you've not seen land, she says. The sky at night is incredible, and the sunsets every single day were out of this world. It's hard not to pine for those days in the new universe of shields on, shields on. The rest of the world does fade away, says Chan. You're on the ship, and it's just the sea in every direction. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.